Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. This morning we're going to talk about the development of Sachsenhausen concentration camp and look at the specific historical context in which Sachsenhausen emerges and when during the Nazi regime it develops. Now previously, probably about 2 years ago now, I did a podcast on the subject of the development of the Nazi camp system. And the point in there is that in the early years it's incredibly chaotic. It's done at a rapid speed during Hitler's consolidation of power. There are grassroots initiatives all the way down to simply SA men keeping people in basements and in the back rooms of bars and beer kellers. These things are referred to essentially as camps. And it's also done with various different agencies of the state and the Nazi regime competing with one another. And as I've said time and time again in this podcast, that institutional chaos is one of the hallmarks of Hitler's regime. Now, Sachsenhausen comes along later on in 1936. The ground begins to be cleared for Sachsenhausen by prisoners from the Arienburg camp during the Berlin Olympics that year. So Sachsenhausen represents a kind of a different phase of the development of the camp system, different from Dachau. Now, for those that are new to the study of Hitler's camps, there is a couple of fundamental distinctions here. Obviously, camps like Dachau and Sachsenhausen are fundamentally different from the Reinhard action camps and other death camps established in Poland during the war. People die in places like Dachau and Sachsenhausen, but they are not specifically designed as factories of death. Far from it. They have a range of purposes. Initially, they were dumping grounds for political undesirables. They purported to have this reformative, restorative, and transformative quality about them, whereby good Germans, good members of the Volksgemeinschaft, would be created through hard labour, and people with these cosmopolitan and Judeo-Bolshevik ideas, as Hitler alleged, would be have it sort of sweated out of them. And that they would understand through physical labour how they could become a useful member of the people's community once again and become part of the society that Hitler was hoping to build, where work and warfare were going to be these transformative energies that would change the German people. And Hitler obviously believed that the German people needed changing, because they certainly wouldn't have lost the previous World War had they been up to the task. So that was initially the point of these camps. But from about 1934-35 onwards, there is also an economic function there as well. And the ability to economically exploit the camps for their labour value and set workers to developing not just the rest of the camp system or the infrastructure of the new Nazi state, but also to supply surplus value to German businesses. That develops from slightly after the initial chaotic period. Now, as I've mentioned before, Nicholas Vauchmann's amazing book, KL, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps, is widely considered to be the benchmark for all other studies on this subject area. It's a phenomenal book, and if you're interested in the Nazi camp system, it contains within it the overall big narrative of the camps from the early days all the way through to the death camps during the wars. There was an Applebaum's book on Stalin's gulags. It's kind of the equivalent study in the Soviet Union. Not saying that there aren't other things written on these two subject areas, but as far as a combined approach goes, if you just have one book to read, then Gulag and KL are probably the best ones to get. Sachsenhausen stands slightly north of Berlin on the edge of Oranienburg. And it was built by prisoners, and Himmler saw the necessity for a new camp close to Berlin as being urgent. Not only was Berlin, in the eyes of the Nazis, a hotbed of Marxist subversion, it was frequently referred to throughout the 1920s as Red Berlin, and a place of worker politics and activism. But also, the camp that Berlin had was concentrated in one small building, the Columbia House, which had been a Gestapo prison and has been taken over by the camp administration, the IKL, in December 1934. This camp was too small, and actually finding somewhere that was out of the city and out of the kind of the gaze of the general public was probably all to the good. In the spring of 1936, SS planners had found a large area of woodland northeast of Oranienburg, where there was easy access to Berlin and yet ideal sort of geographical circumstances for building. It was Theodor Eich and Himmler who looked at the site and thought that a camp should go ahead there. And it begins to replace earlier camps, now considered redundant or not fit for purpose, and starts to draw prisoners in, Sachsenhausen is built, from those centres. And Sachsenhausen quickly becomes the flagship camp in the network. Obviously, the first one is Dachau, and Dachau was not just a prison camp, but kind of like a training college for SS men. Many of the perpetrators of the Holocaust cut their teeth at Dachau originally and learn every trick in the book when it comes to terrorising prisoners, ruling through force and discipline and torture. The sister camp to Sachsenhausen in Thuringia was Buchenwald, which was built roughly the same time. And what we can see here is many of the smaller ad hoc camps that were considered not fit for purpose started to be either shut down or simply handed over to the state to be developed as mainstream prisons. And instead, there were, almost in the eyes of Himmler, fewer but better kind of super camps, these bigger and more purpose-built institutions. Why did they start to do this? Well, is it simply because they thought the other camps were insecure and prisoners were getting away? Well, the number of escapes are so low that that doesn't seem like a credible possibility. Is it because the other camps weren't sufficiently terrorising and brutalising their inmates? Well, if you look at the accounts of people that had been in these sort of ad hoc camps, then that doesn't seem like a possibility as well. One small camp, Esterwegen, had been one of the very first camps, and inmates there had been sent to develop the Emsland moors and turn them into farmland, which obviously kind of fails miserably, but the work there is grueling and the punishment is extreme. So it doesn't seem like people were getting a soft ride and then were coming for real discipline at places like Buchenwald and Sachsenhausen. What I suspect the answer here is the camps were not, in Himmler's eyes, fulfilling their transformative role, and that a camp that was designed around with the kind of the architecture of discipline, the architecture of mass observation and constant surveillance, and with the ability to house sufficient guards to police prisoners as they worked in and outside the camp. These kinds of things would hopefully result in the kind of the transformation of prisoners into model Nazi citizens. obviously, we have to remember that this idea of human psychology is a complete nonsense, and people generally don't become transformed through brutalization. They might become passive and frightened, but you don't change them into different sorts of people, by and large. But this, sometimes we have to understand the madness in order to make sense of the events. And so by looking at what it was the Nazis were hoping to achieve with new camps, we can understand why the camps had developed in the first place. Theodor Eich and Heinrich Himmler in Thuringia hoped that they would be able to build Buchenwald at exactly the same time as Sachsenhausen. But it has to follow the following year. So the site was found in May 1937, and it was built close to the town of Weimar. It was actually built at the site where Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, the famous German poet, had lived and worked. And there is a large oak tree on the site that was associated with him and appeared in his works. And it was protected, and obviously the Nazis were loath to tear it down. And so they built around it, and the oak tree was in the heart of the camp itself. And the tree kind of served as a metaphor, really, for what had happened to Germany, about how the Nazi party and the state had now worked together to really kind of co-opt and encompass and capture German culture. And for those who are not really au fait with late 18th century, early 19th century literary figures, Goethe has an equivalent standing within German culture to Shakespeare in Britain, also Moliere in France. This passage from KL kind of encapsulates the changes that were happening in the later 1930s. Waschmann writes, "The landscape of SS terror was changing fast in the second half of the 1930s. Camps that had been hurriedly set up during the Nazi capture of power were replaced by tailor-made structures meant to last. Of the four camps under Eich's control in late 1937, only Lichtenberg and Dachau had their roots in 1933, and Dachau was already in the midst of a major rebuilding program. Much of the old munitions factory at Dachau was torn down to make way for a permanent new camp. SS leaders saw newly built KL as the future. Himmler and Eich enthused about such modern camps, as they called them, and over the coming years added another three, Flossenbürg in May 1938, Mauthausen in August 1938, and Ravensbrück in May 1939, the first SS concentration camp specially constructed for women, which replaced Lichtenberg. What made the new camp so novel in the eyes of Himmler and Eich was not their internal organisation or the Guards' ethos, both of which followed the old Dachau model. Rather, it was their functional design. The new concentration camps were planned as small cities of terror, holding masses of prisoners. At a time when the SS system held less than 5,000 prisoners, Sachsenhausen and Buchenwald were projected for 6,000 men each." So what we can see here is that there was a predicted and a planned dramatic escalation in prison populations towards the end of the 1930s. Why was there's such a great interest in the mind of Himmler for such a dramatic expansion in camp sizes? Well, no doubt the war that was being planned at this stage by Hitler had something to do with it. What shape that war would take was at this stage perhaps unclear, but certainly there might be the need to accommodate prisoners from newly acquired territories in Austria, in the Czech provinces of Czechoslovakia that were to be assimilated into the Reich, And perhaps even in Poland, though it turns out in the long run, the Poles are terrorised on their own territory. The plan that Himmler had was that there would be no upper limit on prisoner numbers, and that there was a system of rapid expansion whereby if there was the need for more camps, that those could be very quickly created. And that this meant that there was to be really a boundless terror, a terror that knew no boundaries. Now, the terror of the first half of the 1930s, there is a kind of a complicated affair. Between 1933 and 1934, much of it is a kind of a grassroots SA-led terror that is quite indiscriminate and makes the regime quite unpopular. During the second half of the 1930s, the actual numbers of Gestapo men there to police the population and the SS as well is far smaller than had been previously popularly thought, and often the job of tracking down dissenting individuals and dissenting voices isn't done by the Gestapo, it's done by ordinary Germans themselves through denunciation. There is a quote by Roger Moorhouse in Berlin at War, where he says essentially there was less work to do by Gestapo men in terms of actually investigating, and more through just sifting the mountains of denunciations they get. These cities of terror, places like Sachsenhausen and Buchenwald, which were built over 80 and 100 hectares of land apiece, became huge sites of infrastructure in themselves. There were different parts of the camp connected by roads. There was a whole slew of support institutions around them, from water pumping stations to residential blocks for guards, administrative offices, workshops, garages, storehouses, everything that a modern commercial enterprise would need. And these are commercial enterprises. They run on slavery, and they attempted at least to turn a profit. Things had also changed since the early days of the camps in terms of transparency and secrecy. The initial easy access that German people had to Dachau, where it was possible to walk past the camp, it was visible from tram routes, and from it was possible to cycle past it. And whilst there were punishments for trying to peer over the walls or look inside, it was useful, the regime initially thought, to have the public know that the camps were there, not only as a threat to ordinary Germans who might choose to defy the regime, but also in an attempt to try to reassure German citizens that things were being done to deal with the troublemakers. And that often there were conversations being had around the camps by citizens of the New Reich saying, well, if they're in there, if the communists are in there, it's because they were going to do something bad, and I'm sure Hitler wouldn't throw people in jail for no good reason. People often come up with all sorts of rationalisations and justifications when governments act in arbitrary and authoritarian ways. However, Sachsenhausen and Buchenwald, neither of those employ the same kinds of practices, and secrecy becomes much more important at this phase. By 1939, the guards at Dachau, most of them lived with the nearby Dachau population and in the local town. A fifth of them, they made up a fifth of the local town population. The new camps were, however, much more carefully concealed, and they were put deliberately in far more remote locations, and this was to attract the minimum amount of attention and to facilitate the least amount of contact with the public at large. It was often hoped by local townspeople or people who were the nearest to a new camp that there would be some kind of economic benefit for them, that it would generate economic activity, and that they would either be able to sell goods and services to the camp, or there would be some kind of employment there. The new camps made that quite an unlikely proposition. They were more autonomous, so they were more contained communities within themselves and could provide most of what they needed for themselves, not needing to buy services or goods from local towns. And the fact obviously remained that the camps also had an inexhaustible supply of free labour, much of it skilled. Camps had become more self-sufficient with all sorts of prisoner-led or prisoner-supplied labour in terms of joinery, shoemaking, tailoring, blacksmithing, and the rest. And this meant that the camps had less of a relationship with the surrounding area, and it also meant that the camps had less of a relationship with Germans who lived beyond the local area. In fact, the camps start to not necessarily vanish from German national discourse and thinking throughout the later 1930s, but they certainly become less prominent and less visible. The regime at this point was fully established. It didn't need to have citizens walking past the gates of camps thinking, "There, but for the grace of God go I," or "Whoever's in there needs to be in there, and I'm being well looked after by the Führer." The system of rulership in Germany was, by the Nazi regime, was firmly established, and so that was largely unnecessary. And now the work of the camps was possible, was able to continue in secrecy, and this was obviously all to the good as far as the regime was concerned. Hitler and Himmler rarely ever referred to the camps, and there is one example, actually, when Himmler does, on the 29th of January 1939, during a radio address for the Day of the German Police, which is a national holiday. Himmler said that the camps were strict but fair, and he said their function was to reform. He said, and I quote from Waschmann, "The slogan that stands above these camps is, 'There is a path to freedom. Its milestones are obedience, diligence, honesty, orderliness, cleanliness, sobriety, truthfulness, readiness to make sacrifices, and love of the fatherland.'" And this, really, that Himmler believed that the camps were kind of schools for teaching this sort of thing, and that they were places where a new kind of Germany would be, forged, factories for new kinds of German people. This explains why there was often relatively short sentences, about 18 months to 2 years for prisoners, and who were released back into society. None of them educated in anything other than terror. Personally, emotionally and spiritually broken individuals who gave the outward appearance of conformity, but who were simply traumatized into dropping all pretense of resistance. Anyway, I'm going to finish there, and we'll be returning to this topic in the near future. There'll be another couple of podcasts coming out later this week on an eclectic range of topics. So if you found this useful, do pop over to our Facebook page, say hi. It's always great to hear from you guys, and give us a good thumbs up if you can on iTunes. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you all soon. All the best. Bye-bye.